format of this meeting, for this meeting, is a 10-minute speaker, our secretary's announcements, a coffee and snack break, and then our main speaker. Our first speaker tonight is Jim. Jim?
Hello, I'm Jim, alcoholic.
Whoa. I'm coming up on 2 years next month, and I haven't, this is my first speaking. So, needless to say, I'm pretty nervous. I don't know what I'm going to say, but I know it's going to be the truth, because that's what I've learned here. That's what they told me to say, was just tell the truth. Start at the beginning, I guess. I came from a family of alcoholics. Mom, dad, brother, sister. And my brother was 10 years older, my sister 4 years older. And by the time I got old enough to know what was going on around the house, my brother was already gone. And my sister moved out when she was 16 because my dad... wasn't home a lot. He worked, he was in the search and rescue for the sheriff's department. And he worked long hours. And my mom was an alcoholic. And this kind of, she was the kind of person where you get up in the morning and she was the sweetest lady you'd ever want to meet, you know. But when I got home from school, it was like she was a witch. And, you know, I just, it was like typical Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and I really didn't understand what was going on until, you know, preteens or, you know, junior high school, excuse me, and I started really disrespecting her a lot, because, you know, every night when I was a kid, I would just cry myself to sleep, and I didn't understand why, you know, she thought I was such a bad kid. So by the time I got in high school, I found a couple of buds to run with, and I wouldn't come home at night, you know. We'd just go out, and that's when I really started drinking. I actually started drinking in junior high, but by the time I was in high school, I was drinking as much as I could, you know, on the weekends. And then by my senior year, it was like we would take, I had a little camper on the back of my truck, and we wouldn't even get to school. We'd go to the nearest liquor store and load it up with beer and drive into the parking lot, you know, at school, and never make it to class anyway. But so as soon as I got out of high school, I moved out. I was 17. I moved out with 3 other friends, and we went to Long Beach City College, which was like a big geographic for me. But we all like to, you know, we all drank every night. We partied. And the other 3 guys, you know, they would get up and go to school the next day. But I'd just wake up and go to the refrigerator, you know. And I couldn't figure out how those guys made it to school. And I blew a lot of opportunities. I had a lot of opportunities, good job offers from my relatives and but, you know, the drink or the school and the job offers were getting in the way of my drinking. So until I turned 21, then a good buddy of mine, actually the guy that I moved out with, he had graduated from college and came back and he opened up a bar here in Hermosa Beach. And I got a job bartending for him. So I figured I had it, you know, that was something I could do. A job that I could do and still drink and get, and you know, drink for free and you know, get paid for it, and it was just a great deal. And I ended up getting a place down in Hermosa so I wouldn't have to drive, about a block from the bar. And met a girl down there. She needed a place to stay. She was a waitress looking for a job. I gave her a job and a place to stay. And she also had some friends from Latin America that used to visit us occasionally. and we had a lot of them. So I didn't have to pay for any of that either. So I just thought, I thought I was on top of the world. But needless to say, it didn't take very long before I was just about ready to kill myself. So I made a bigger geographic this time. I went to Escondido, and that's where my grandparents lived. And I went down there on a Thursday, I remember, and I was going to stay there a few weeks and clean my act up. But Friday, I was down at the Lamplighter looking for, you know, Coke and having a few Crown Royal and water. And so I knew I was just kidding myself. But that was like when I was 25, and it right then, you know, it was like the beginning of my own program, you know. And I didn't know anything about AA, and I didn't know anybody. I had so many friends around me that were so far from AA, I didn't know how I was ever going to stumble upon it. Excuse me. But it was a terrible cycle of trying to give up on my own, quitting on my own, you know, working out, the whole nine yards. And, I mean, it was just a nightmare. Nothing worked. And about that time, my mom called me and told me that my brother had died from heroin. He was in a rehab at the veterans place up here by UCLA, and he got out and decided he wasn't done yet, and he killed himself. And after that, it didn't even, you know, that wasn't going to make me stop drinking or using. I was just still on that same vicious cycle. And then it was 1992. My dad had retired, and I guess he couldn't put up with my mom anymore, but he couldn't leave. And he had started drinking heavily after he retired. I guess he was an alcoholic all the time, because he drank every night, but he just had like one glass of beef eaters a night, you know. So he wasn't an alcoholic, I thought. But he decided to go out in the backyard and put his .38 service revolver to his head. And I remember when the coroner came and took him away, I was standing across the street and you know, drinking a beer. And still, I wasn't done. But I don't know, it was 2 years ago, 2 days after Christmas. It was pretty uneventful. I don't think it was because of the holidays or anything. I just thought I had enough. And I had a buddy of mine who had, who I ran with, who was the second biggest asshole I know. And I'd seen what he had done. He had been dry or sober or whatever you called it for, you know, a couple of years. He got his own business, and things were thriving for him. You know, he was driving a nice car, and I thought, what the hell are you doing, you know? And he said, well, you just let me know when you want to go to a meeting. So he took me to the Monday Night Men's Stag in Hermosa. Same town where I, you know, was at my highlight of my drinking career. And from that first meeting, I mean, I know now that from that first meeting, my obsession was lifted. It was an amazing thing. I saw these guys walking around like John, you know, just beaming and smiling like they had some secret, you know. And I wanted what they had. And I was told right away that I was full of shit. And I was a liar. And I was. And I didn't know it. I didn't know that I was such a liar. But somebody told me once that they used to call me Mr. Bullshit behind my back, you know. And that was news to me. But that's what I learned. I learned it that I got my sponsor from that meeting. And I wasn't one that really, you know, went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I didn't do that. It was kind of a slow roll. But I got the fire now. I don't know if I would have gone to 90 and 90, I don't know if I might have burned out. I'm not sure. It just worked out the way it was supposed to, I think. I started working the steps, and the fourth and the fifth step was, it really did a lot for me. It really changed me a lot. And I'm working on my ninth right now, and I'm looking forward to the promises. And
guaranteed.
Yeah, guaranteed. But it's just, it really has changed my life. I've learned to tell the truth. I'm living life now, you know. It's just, it's incredible. It's a great gift, and there's a lot of newcomers here. And, you know, just keep coming back, like they say. Listen to all the hokey little sayings they have and everything, because, you know, it's an unbelievable gift. And it would be a shame to lose it. And my life is going really good now. It's not all, you know, roses, but it's so much better than it was. It's so much better. And I just want to say I've seen Father Leo before, and it's an honor to speak before him. I thank God I don't have to follow him. It's been a real pleasure, and thanks a lot.
Now, our main speaker will share his experience, strength, and hope with us. Please join me in welcoming Father Leo from Long Beach.
Hi, everybody. My name's Leo, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Leo.
First of all, I want to say it's a real joy, privilege. A friend of Andy's. You know Andy, right?
Yeah.
I'm one of the few friends of Andy's. That's right. Don't forget the cigars, Andy. I'm a friend of Andy's, and we talked about me being here. I was very excited to be here. As some of you know, I have a church in Hawthorne, so it's not too far for me to come over. And it's a joy and it's a privilege. My name's Leon. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober. I got sober on the 4th of July, 1977. In England, we don't keep the 4th of July. You probably remember that. But anyway, it was a very special day for me. And it's very nice when I'm over here. I've been over here in England now. You can tell I'm from England, not from Ohio. Right? I'm from England, where men are men and sheep are nervous. And I was speaking in Chicago at a big... It wasn't just an AA meeting, it was also a conference. But I made an AA meeting in Chicago while I was there, and I was flying over, and we had some turbulence. The lady next to me said to me, she said, "Oh, thank God you're on the aeroplane," because she saw my collar. I said, "I don't know why you're thanking me. I'm not driving the aeroplane." She said, where have you been? I said, "I've been speaking to alcoholics." She says, "Oh, my God," she says, "they're all over the place now." I said, "I know, one of them sitting next to you." She said, "You don't look like an alcoholic." Well, of course, we know that it's not what you look, it's not how much you drink, it's not what, you know, the amount you drink or the choice of drink, it's the effects. So I'm very delighted to be able to share my story with you. I told you I was from England. You have Dean Martin, we had Winston Churchill. How many of you know that Winston Churchill used to drink a bottle of brandy a day? How many of you know that? Oh, good, you read too. Great. Winston Churchill, about a bottle of brandy a day. Now, I don't know whether Winston was alcoholic or not, but there are some stories told about Winston that some of you will find interesting. Winston Churchill was sitting at dinner with Lady Astor. And Lady Astor turned to Winston Churchill and said, "Winnie, Winnie, you're drunk." Winston Churchill, in his inimitable way, said, "Madam, you are ugly." "But I shall wake up sober in the morning." She was very quick to say to him, she said, "Winnie, Winnie, if I was your wife, I'd put poison in your soup." "Madam, if I was your husband, I'd drink it." You know, when you talk about alcoholism, we mustn't forget the ism. Alcoholism. And it's the ism that you heard described in that joke. The arrogance, the manipulation, the tricky-dicky behavior of Winston Churchill. And there isn't anybody here who can't identify with that. It occurred to me that if you can find the disease in a joke, you should also be able to find recovery in humor. Am I right? No, am I right? Yes, indeed. We got some Al-Anons here. Yes, Al-Anons here. Don't be shy. Anybody Al-Anon? Yes? Don't be shy. You never used to be. It's a lovely story. A lady with 4 years in Al-Anon. How many years?
Four.
How many years?
Four.
That's right. 4 years in Al-Anon. But she married very badly. She married a very old-fashioned man. And on their wedding night, he took her to the bedroom, and he took off his trousers, and he threw his trousers in the middle of the floor, and he said, "Wife, you get into those trousers." She said, "I can't get into those trousers." He said, "No, and don't you ever forget who wears the trousers in this marriage." He's old-fashioned. But how many years did she have in Al-Anon? How many?
Four.
She didn't know more. She took off her panties. And she threw her panties into the middle of the bedroom. She said, "Husband, get into those panties." He said, "I can't get into those panties." She says, "No, and you won't until you change your attitude." Now, some of you may be thinking, what's recovery got to do with panties? Everything. Think about it, everything. Yes. Am I not right in saying this to you? Recovery is about taking care of yourself, am I right? Recovery is for the very first time. And some of you may not always realize you're doing it. I know I sometimes don't. But when you start establishing boundaries for yourself, some things are not acceptable anymore. Some ways of being treated are not acceptable anymore. It comes from this program. Because there are so many people here who are new, I just want to share with you, it's only the first step, and there are 12 steps. It's only the first step that talks about alcohol. Every other step is a step to self-esteem and self-worth. Every other step is a step to dignity and spirituality. And notice, by the way, I said spirituality, not religion. Somebody said years ago, and they said it so well, religion is man-made. Spirituality is God-given. You agree?
Yes.
Religion can divide people up. Spirituality teaches the world to hold hands. We are talking about a spiritual program, not a religious program. I happen to be Episcopal. That's Catholic light. Ha ha ha! I am to be Episcopal, but I was raised, just for you to know, I was raised Roman Catholic. I was raised to be a Jesuit. But I left on the issue of birth control. I wasn't the only one, but I left. I'm only sharing that with you to let you know spirituality. It's not about a religion. This is not a Christian movement. Many of us in this room are Christians, but it's not a Christian movement. I was in India last year, in Delhi. There were about two meetings I went to during my stay in Delhi, and I was the only Christian there. Same steps, same tradition. But they were Hindu. I've been to Arab countries where this 12-step program is alive, and Thailand, which is Buddhist. This is not about being a Christian. This is about being spiritual. And you are promised, somebody, Jim, by the way, I want to acknowledge Jim with a 10-minute speaker. Very, very, very important for me to hear other people in here, Jim. The promises begin on the 12th step. When we reach our 12th step, we start to participate in this most glorious promise. Having had a spiritual awakening. Awakening. You wake up. Hello. You wake up. Whatever is going to happen to you today, whatever people say about you, how people hurt you, whatever problems you're having today, and some of us are, we must remember it's never as bad as what it was like when we were drinking and using. That's why there are speakers who will say pertinently, my worst day in recovery is better than my best day when I was drinking. Having had a spiritual awakening. And by the way, for some of you here, realize, when you think that this program, this 12-step program was written 50-odd years ago, he talked about discover a God as you understand God. Not a God of a pope or a mullah, God of a rabbi, a God as you understand God. And on our journey, we will start to discover a God that we can relate to, that is about being sober, and it's about being honest, and it's about being willing to bend. If I get time to talk about it this evening, I'll talk about the difference. The difference, how I understand it, between being sober and being dry. And there is a difference. There is a difference. Sober is a willingness to bend. Now I'm going to do what speakers are supposed to do, and that is to say what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I have a few minutes to do that before we end. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. The fact that I happen to be a priest working here in Hawthorne makes no difference whether you're a teacher, doesn't make any difference who you are, whether you're a woman, whether you're a mother. Because the disease of alcoholism is very, very similar. The faces change, the incidents change, but the unmanageability and the powerlessness is the same. I started to drink when I was about 14 years of age in England. And in the school that I was staying at, they used to give you beer to drink in the evenings before you went to sleep. Before you went to sleepies. Little sleepies. Give you a little drinky. Drinkies before sleepies. And it wasn't so much that I got drunk, and it wasn't so much that I liked the taste, but I liked how I felt when I drank. I liked how I felt when I drank. Get some old tapes of Chuck C. You listen to Clancy, you listen to some of the speakers throughout the United States, and they're the best in the world. You'll hear time and time again, alcoholism is the disease of the feelings. I'm 5'7". 5'8" on a very good day. But when I drank alcohol, I felt 6'2". Oh, I felt bigger. I had a stutter. We're talking stutter. But when I drank, my stutter left. I didn't have a stutter. I thought I'd found a friend in the glass. Oh, what a friend. You know what a friend we have in Jesus? What a friend we have in bourbon. I thought I'd found a friend. And I tell you, I was to drink all through university. I went through some good universities. And then in 1971, I was ordained in Durham Cathedral to the Episcopal Church in England. And I was let loose on a church. And just like you, I had to have a reason to drink. And I said, the lost and the lonely, those sheep without a shepherd, oh, they need me. I don't know where they are. They're all in the bar. Now, if you go in a bar dressed like this, people notice you. There's a penguin at the end of the bar. A walking oil slick's just come in. And everybody likes to talk to a priest, even if they don't like you. They like to talk to you. People would say, give the priest a drink, give him two, give him a triple. And they'd come over and they'd say, you're the kind of priest we like. You're down to earth. Oh, Jesus sent you to us. You're the kind of priest we like. You smoke like we smoke. You drink like we drink. You throw up like we throw up. People liked you. People started to come from the bars to church. As you know, it's normally the other way. But they started to come from the bars to church. One woman said to her husband, shall we stay at home and listen to Benny Hill? Or shall we go to church? Listen to Father Leo. Same thing's going to happen. I've said it 1,000 times. If you're a nurse and you're an alcoholic, there's going to be times you're going to be drunk in the hospital. If you're a housewife and an alcoholic, there's going to be times you're drunk at the house. If you're a doctor and an alcoholic, there's going to be times you're drunk in the surgery. If you're a priest and an alcoholic, there's going to be times you're drunk doing the service. I remember once doing a funeral, drunk. I followed the coffin into the hole. I tell you, it's real scary when you hear the amens coming from above. But it was an Irish funeral. Nobody cared. There's the priest in the hole. The priest is in the hole, full of dirt. Get the priest out of the hole. They got me out. I just carried on. Nobody was bothered. Kind of like you expect the priest to fall in the hole. Nobody gets to know about that unless I tell them. Then I tell them when I tell them. They know. But the next time, because you have things that happen to you that you know. No one else knows, but you know. And you may tell people. The next incident, people got to know. I couldn't keep it a secret. I was doing a baptism. Oh, yes, I was doing a baptism a few weeks after the funeral. Changed my clothes. I was clean. I was doing the baptism. It was a happy time. People were just happy. People flew in, relatives, grandparents, happy. happy time. Everybody was there for the baby's baptism, and then I appeared. Now, I wasn't drunk, but I was mellow. You know, when you're mellow, you don't need any help. Give me the baby. Just give me the baby. I baptize the baby in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, Daphne. I didn't ask anybody. It's Daphne. The mother, she let loose such a scream. Ah! She said, Father Leo, it's a little boy. Said, I don't care what the hell it is. It's Daphne now. She said, is there anything we can do about it? I said, no. Forever and a day, he will be called Daphne. How do you make amends to a thing like that? But the mother, she sent a letter. A letter to the bishop. I got a call from the bishop. He said, Booth, I want to see you tomorrow. Put the phone down. I'd forgotten about the baptism. I thought, why does the bishop want to see me? Then I got it. Promotion. I go to see the bishop, and the bishop, he's a small man. He looks at me straight in the eyes. He's small. He said, I've got a letter. A letter. A letter. I said, good. He said, it's about you, you fool. Why, you fool? He said, are you sick? Are you demented? Are you having a nervous breakdown? What's the matter with you? And then he looks at me straight in the eyes. We're talking straight in the eyes. In the eyes, he said. Had you been drinking? Had you been drinking? Now see if you can identify with this. Who? Me? I swear on the Bible. I swear on the Bible. But he didn't believe me. But he couldn't prove it. Ha! Ha! Have you ever been in that situation? When you're telling a lie? And you know you're telling a lie, and they know you're telling a lie, and you know that they know you're telling a lie, but they can't prove it. But a bishop said, he said, oh, he was angry. He was angry. He's a bishop who's angry. Oh, purple bishop. This bishop needed Al-Anon. He said, he just said it. It just came out of his mouth. He said, quit it. I said, quit it. He said, just quit it. I said, quit it. He said, quit it. I said, I'll quit it. He said, quit it. Just stop it. Just stop it. You ever heard that from anyone? Just stop it. Quit it. I said, I'll quit it. I'm going home from the bishop. I'll quit it. I'll just stop. Cunning. Baffling. Powerful. You know what? I stopped for 6 months. And I thought, because I hadn't had a drink for 6 months, I was an alcoholic. Cunning, baffling, powerful. Ooh. And patient. This is a disease that can wait. It has eternity to wait. I didn't drink for 6 months. And I'm not going to be the first alcoholic to say to you they were the worst 6 months. Dry. I wasn't sober. I was dry. Sometimes you find there are some people in meetings who are dry. They are not sober. Dry is like a dry leaf. Dry is like a dry leaf. Any pressure and you snap. Any pressure and you break. About 2 years ago, I went to speak at a Dallas AA convention. Man picked me up in a Cadillac. He had 2 years. He was taking me. He was sent by the conference AA to meet me as a speaker. And he drove me. And he got in his car. In a Cadillac. The lights changed to red. He went, God, I hate it when the lights change. He said, don't worry, Horace. They'll change back. Can you imagine living with him? Can you imagine? Dry. Sobriety is when you have the ability to bend. A leaf that is supple, not dry, can bend. You can find criticism of anybody if you want to. You can find fault with the big book. You can find fault with the step. And the promises. You can find fault with the speaker. You can even find fault with the toilet roll. There is no limit to what you can find fault with if you want. This program is not about perfection. It's about progress. We seek progress rather than perfection. We are a people with the ability to bend. I didn't drink for 6 months. And in that 6 months, I tell you, I was out of control, angry. I missed so much my friend. And I stopped for the bishop. Maybe some of you have stopped for your wife, for your children, for your husband, for your friend, for your health, for your job. Until you stop for yourself, you'll never embrace sobriety. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. 6 months I didn't drink. And then you may say, when did you have your slip? Because you did drink again. I said, oh, yeah. On a Thursday. An ordinary day. It was raining. It's always raining in England on a Thursday. An ordinary day in England. Thursday. Some people think you're going to have a slip on a Saturday or Thanksgiving or Christmas Eve. No, Thursday. Thursday. Watch out for Thursdays. Wet days. An ordinary day. An ordinary man. An extraordinary event. I went to a party on a Thursday. And I was drinking 7-Up. I'd been drinking 7-Up for 6 months. I was fizzed out on 7-Up. And then we have what the program calls a coincidence. Some of you who've read the Celestine Prophecy, a coincidence. When God works a miracle, anonymously, a coincidence. Somebody was at that party who knew me 7 years before, when I was at St. Barnabas Hove in Sussex. And she said, "Father Leo, what are you drinking?" I said, "Seven Up." She said, "Seven Up? You're not a Seven Up man. You're gin and tonic." I said, "I'm drinking Seven Up now." She said, "Have a gin and tonic." I said, "No." She said, "Go. Have a large gin and tonic." I said, "Okay." Cunning. Baffling. Powerful. Patient. A Thursday. An ordinary day. Raining. I had a drink. Now some of you are going to say, "That's it! That's it! Betty was as drunk as a skunk!" No, it's very cunning. I had two drinks and I went home. I drove home. I wasn't drunk. Gracious me, there were many times I didn't get drunk. Sometimes we make alcoholism too small. We say an alcoholic always gets drunk. An alcoholic drinks all day and every day. An alcoholic drinks in the morning. It's just not true. It's our grandiosity as we speak, but it's not true. Sometimes we drink and it was all right. That's why it's so insane. That's why it's so difficult. Sometimes we didn't always get drunk and we didn't always drink every morning. And we didn't drink three bottles every day. That would be so easy. The reason why you battle 10 years and 5 years and 9 years is because alcoholism places that question mark at the center of your mind. And even those who love you most are sometimes not sure. Is she? Is he? I've been with him when he didn't get drunk. I've been with her when she was fine. It's a very cunning and it's a very baffling and, gracious me, very powerful disease. It's not easy to get. As I speak, most alcoholics are not here. Most alcoholics never get sober. Most alcoholics die in their wet beds. It's probably the most horrendous disease on this planet because of the denial. I had two drinks, I went home. But here's an extraordinary thing, another extraordinary event, a watch. You may say, "What the hell, a watch? Why the watch? The man is crazy." It's a watch. I left a watch in a restroom. At the party. The next morning I woke up, "Where's my watch?" It's a nice watch. "Where's my watch?" So I called the barman. "I lost my watch." He says, "Come." I found the watch. I said, "Good, I go." I go in, same bar, same barman. He says, "Have a drink." "Have one for the road." Last night I had two drinks. I went home. That morning, when I got the watch, he gave me a drink. And if you're an alcoholic, you know what I mean. The lion was disturbed. Now I needed to drink. Last night, didn't. Cunning. Baffling. I needed to drink. I had two drinks with him. Then I went to another bar and another bar. And by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was as drunk as a skunk. My car hit a tree and it hit a lamppost. And the car shot up in the air. Two old ladies in the garden said, "Look, there goes Father Leo." That's how he travels now. Look, I didn't stay up there. Came down, crash, bang. Cut my leg, my face. And I was sitting at the side of the road. And I had a moment. A moment. And I believe that everybody who's here has had that moment. My moment was I was sitting at the side of the road and I stood outside of myself and I saw me bleeding and I saw me hurt. And you know, in very simple words, I didn't like what I saw. I didn't want to be that man. A moment. I believe that God was sending moments every day, every hour, every second of my life. But this day, I coincided with God's moment. And I've held on to that moment for 17, 18 years. I don't think there's a day that goes by without me not thinking of the moment. Every time I come to a meeting and listen to a gym, I hear my moment. Everybody here has had a moment. A moment when you reached, and you hear me now, you reached up and you held what you understand by your God, your higher power. God wanted you sober every day you were drunk. But on the 4th of July 1977, I wanted it. I wanted it. If I hadn't have wanted it, it never would have happened. What was your moment? Mine, a car crash. Yours might have been when somebody who you love more than the whole world, and you hit the person that you love more than the whole world, and you suddenly realize. Maybe for you, it's when your child, your little girl, your little boy, you don't know them. It's your little girl and your little boy, and you don't know them. And worse, they don't know you. A moment. The moment might have been when it's your mother who's given herself for you every day, and she's crying about you. There's 1,000 moments in this room. But I tell you why some people relapse. It's not complicated. For those of you who are new here, and you talk about relapse, I tell you why. It's very simple. You forget your moment. You forget your moment and you're lost. So then that brings me to Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of remembrance. That's all it is. We've been going over 50 years because we have here and here a program of remembrance. We remember what it was like. What happened. What it's like now. The Jews say, let the world remember what happened. Because if they don't remember, it might all come back. So do we. With the alcoholic holocaust, it's the same. We choose to remember. And I've never met a person who's relapsed. I've never met a person who's had a slip. I've never met a person who's gone out there, phrase it the way you will, who's ever remembered their moment. You don't go to meetings, you don't have a sponsor, you don't read your big book, you're not familiar with all this stuff, and of course, this cunning, baffling, and powerful disease wins yet again. Sometimes people think God wants you sober, of course. But it doesn't start to happen until you want it to. I've made something of a reputation of myself for emphasizing the power, I believe, the power of the human being. You see, I believe that miracle happens when human beings start to do extraordinary things. Because I believe that God's divinity is expressed in every one of us. That's my belief. I believe that when you start to work these steps, work them, something extraordinary happens. Because after that car crash, I went to a treatment center, and then I went to AA, just like you. And for the last 18 years, I've been going to AA. I speak, and I go and I listen, all over. And I see that it's called 12 steps. What is it called, 12?
Steps.
What is it?
Steps.
Nobody ever says, Harry, will you come forward and read the 12 stand still? This is not about standing still. This is 12.
Yes.
We're on the move. We are on the move, and if I never see you again, we are on the move. This is about steps. This is about journey. This is about movement. There are philosophers who've looked at this program, and it is incredible. But it starts and ends with you. This is not a program just about God. This is a program about you. God doesn't need this program. We do. God is not codependent. God is not going to make you get sober. And I say this to people who sometimes come to these meetings and they thank everybody. They thank God. They thank their sponsor. They thank Bill and Bob. They thank the secretary. My God, if there was a dog in the meeting, they'd thank the dog. But they forget to thank themselves. The reason why you're here is because you're here. Every step involves you. We admitted. Who admitted? We did. Came to believe. Who came to believe? I came to believe. Made a decision. Who made a decision? I made a decision. Having had, who had? I had a spiritual awakening. It's amazing. How so many of us miss the power of this program. God loves the drunk outside there who's still drunk just as much as any of us. God doesn't love you or me anymore because we're sober. But we love ourselves. The miracle starts to happen when we love ourselves. And sometimes people think that turning your life in a new direction is handing your life over to God. It's not the same. Have this visual of you saying to God, God, take my life. Take my life. Take it. And God said, no. Take my life. God said, no. Take, no. And then God looks at you straight in the eyes. Black, Asian, Caucasian, nothing, doesn't matter. And says, why you hand your life back to me? Live it. pain, joy, sweat, laughter will be yours. But live it. Don't you hand it back. It's a gift. We have been given a gift. We struggle, we march, we write, we speak. It's an incredible program. Based on you. You don't turn it, won't happen. You don't make a decision, never happen. It's all about you. Those of us who work, get it. Those of us who struggle, inherit it. An incredible program. It will help you not just with alcoholism. It will help you in your relationships. It will help you in your home. It will help you in your job. What I've done, I've taken it to my church. 80% of my church is recovering. I'm not joking. 80% of my church is recovering. The other 20% should be. I went to Hawthorne, St. George's Hawthorne, one condition, that I would take the 12-step program. That it would be a church that was concerned for the alcoholic who's suffering. By the way, not just the alcoholic, but for the sex addict, for the compulsive overeater, the codependent, the Al-Anon. Because you see, why should a church that has hurt so many of us, a lady came to me, I don't know where she is, but she came to me, shook me by the hand before I spoke. She was a brave. An optimistic. She shook my hand before I spoke. And she said, for years, alcoholism has been seen as a moral failing instead of a disease. And she's right. And churches made alcoholics feel bad years ago. You didn't meet. On the level, you met downstairs, in the basement, at 8 o'clock at night. Why the hell do you think we're anonymous? We're anonymous because over 50 years ago, it was not okay for you to say you're an alcoholic in this world, this society, this church. So I say, it is the church that needs to heal. It is the church. The church needs this program just like any family or any individual. I've done it. You have taken your program to your family, to your relationship, into your life, into your employment. It touches everything. And some of you have already realized that sometimes a relationship is not going to work because the other person does not understand this program. Am I right? Sometimes you must love somebody enough to let them go. Sometimes you must love somebody enough to let them go. Because we talk a certain language, we live a certain way today. Honesty, principles, and a willingness to say we're sorry when we've made problems for others. When we're at fault, we make amends. An incredible program. A program that can change your life. Just for you to know, tomorrow evening, I have a recovery service in my church based on the 12 steps. And I preach on a spiritual theme, not a religious theme. But it is a recovery mass. Every one of you is welcome, and those of you who wish more information, see me afterwards. But this program is not about these rooms. The worst thing we can do is keep this program locked in these rooms. This message of sanctuary, which means peace. Of sanctuary, which means safe, needs to be taken out there. Do you agree with me that if the world understood and lived the 12-step program, it would be a much better world in which to live? Do you agree?
Yes.
So it is for us. You don't have a message. You are the message. It's not what you say. It's how you greet and how you hug and how you smile and how you wink and how you speak. This is a happy, happy program that is based on a spirituality that touches the world. I would love to say more. But time waits for nobody. Not even an AA speaker. So I end tonight with something not from the big book, not from the Bible, but from a country and western song. Oh yes. God can speak through a prophet and a priest. God can speak through the big book and through your sponsor, but God can also. God is limitless. God can speak through a country and western song. The words of this song you probably know. But when you hear them, try to imagine this is what God is saying to you today and every day. God is saying this to you. God is saying, welcome. Welcome to my world. Won't you come on in? Miracles, I guess, well, they still happen now and then. Welcome to my world. And leave your cares behind. Welcome to my world. It was built with you in mind. Knock, and the door will open. Seek, and you will find. Ask, and you will be given the key to this world of mine. And who's the key? You are. You always were. In this program, I can promise you three things. I promise you. You will live like you have never lived before. You will love and start to love yourself like you have never loved before. And third, and just as important, we will laugh. Laugh like we've never laughed before. Thank you very much for listening.